Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, July 2nd. The 4th of July holiday weekend is about to begin. Tomorrow, July 3rd, is the day off from work for people for whom that applies this year, since the 4th itself is on a Saturday this year. But it comes at this weird moment, right, when quarantine fatigue is raging, but so is coronavirus in many American states, and is even a risk around here, the New York area, where virus rates at the moment are lower. So what to do to have fun and be safe? And how do we understand where these spikes are coming from? New York and New Jersey, which were about to reopen for indoor dining, have put that on pause. Bars seem to be especially risky places to be right now. Some places in the South and West have reclosed beaches after opening them. Yet the big protest gatherings don't seem to have caused new spikes. So what do we learn from that about being outdoors? Cases now seem more concentrated among younger adults, too. Better that than in nursing homes, but are millennials and Gen Z the kindling that will still result in the next massive wave of death? White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany claims not kindling at the beginning of a fire, more like embers as the fire is gradually being doused. Embers, the word President Trump has also used.
So I use the word embers because that is what the president has acknowledged that would happen around the country. You would see spikes across the country. He said at times you would see a fire across the country, embers, fires. But at the same time, I would note the increase in cases, the increase in testing, you know, sixfold increase in testing. You identify more cases. I'd also note Secretary Azar said that we've seen nationwide that fatalities at a two-month low. So this is a different situation when those who are testing positive are younger. We have increased tests. We're aware where there are surges. That's why Dr. Birx is on the ground. But we believe we are equipped to handle what we see on the horizon.
So what's really happening and what should be done about it? With us now, Dr. Ashwin Vasan, Professor of Population and Family Health at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, an attending physician at Columbia's Irving Medical Center, and CEO of the mental health nonprofit Fountain House. Thanks for coming back on, Dr. Vasan. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Embers, kindling, what stage of fire are we in?
Smoldering, and in some cases, all out, three or four alarm blaze. What we're seeing in the alarming case rates in places like Arizona, Texas, Florida, and even the rising case rates in California, is that even with the massive increases in testing, we are still only capturing a fraction of the cases that are actually most likely circulating around, and that we have widespread community spread of this virus, and we're only capturing the tip of the iceberg. Some estimates suggest that we're only getting really about 10%, 10 to 15% of the actual virus circulating. And so what that means, despite the fact that, you know, cases are a leading indicator, we call it. So that's what we really want to be tracking. Death rates are what we call a lagging indicator, usually lag several weeks behind. And it's not surprising that death rates are falling because, number one, we're testing people who are not only severely symptomatic, which is what the recommendation was at the beginning of the pandemic, in order in an environment of relatively scarce testing. Number two, we know a lot more about how to treat the virus and how to intervene earlier. We know things like dexamethasone is a very, very successful medication. And so it's not surprising that death rates are falling. But if I was the Trump administration or anyone else, I wouldn't be championing that as a success in light of, you know, positivity rates 6, 7, 8% in some cases, which really suggests that we are having widespread community transmission of coronavirus outside of the Northeast.
Can you talk more about that relationship between the new cases rate and the death rate? Because she said some of the reason the nation just hit 50,000 cases a day for the first time is more testing, but more testing of the mildly ill or asymptomatic also affects the death rate, if I can get a little wonky on the math there. Because if you're only testing very ill people, like we tended to do in the past, a higher percentage of them are going to die. But that's just deaths as a percentage of the COVID population. Are fewer people in America per day dying of COVID than they did in April and May when new cases were actually lower?
Well, that's not true. Fewer people are not dying today. Actually, more people are dying today only because there are greater outbreaks in more places, right? We had a very concentrated and out of control outbreak in New York City and in the Northeast because that was the epicenter. That's where the virus was introduced into the country. So, like I said, I mean, I think it's not surprising that death rates are falling because we are testing, as you rightfully said, we are testing people who are less severely ill. We're intervening earlier, and in some cases, and we are better able to stave off the worst outcomes. And we are doing more in high-risk settings. If you recall, in the beginning of the epidemic, we had massive outbreaks in nursing homes, in correctional settings, and we're doing more in those settings. We're not doing great, but we're doing more than we were several months ago to control those outbreaks in particularly high-risk settings. I think the take-home message here is that we shouldn't be falsely lulled into thinking we're doing better just because deaths are falling because of exactly what you said, which is that we're testing people earlier who are less severely ill. Rather, we should be alarmed by two things. One, the massively rising positivity rate overall. Number two, the fact that hospitalization rates are going up. So you're actually seeing more people get admitted for symptomatic COVID in places like Arizona, Florida, Texas, and the like, the things we've talked about, California as well. And so there is a clear sense that while we are capturing more of the virus, we are not capturing nearly enough. We are not testing widely enough, though we're testing much more than we were in March and April and May. We still have a long ways to go to be doing enough testing. And this is the problem with the overall strategy in the country, which is that because we didn't marshal a massive federal coordinated response, we are somewhere in between a strategy of control in some places, like New York City and New York State, and essentially herd immunity and the Swedish approach, which is just letting the virus pass through the population relatively unchecked. And that's going to have an incredible burden. And that burden is going to fall on already vulnerable people like the elderly, nursing homes, other institutionalized settings, people of color, lower income people, and people with pre-existing conditions. And so there's not only are we at the beginning of this pandemic, we're still at the beginning of this pandemic, mm-hmm. We have a lot more to do, and no one should be taking something like the death rate in isolation to say that we are somehow making meaningful gains as a country on this virus, because we are behind the eight ball. We continue to be behind the eight ball.
How do you explain California? Unlike Texas and Florida, it didn't have a Republican governor denying the problem and opening too early as a matter of politics. In fact, we used to say in New York, you're in New York, so you know, that California avoided our terrible spike because the mayor of San Francisco shut down before the mayor of New York did at the first whiffs. Rather than waiting until things started to get bad, they imposed a stay-at-home order before the virus got out, not after, like in New York. So how did it go bad there?
Yeah, I mean, our response to this pandemic has been politicized. There's no doubt that you're seeing large outbreaks and alarming case rates in states with Republican leadership that have demonstrated poor leadership and poor decision-making in their virus response. But this virus continues to confound us and to alarm us because it doesn't really care what your political party is. you know, the California did a fantastic job in locking down early. The other thing to remember is that California didn't have a major super spreader event like a prison, or in the case of New York City, you know, it didn't have a big entry point like JFK. It closed down its airports as well. You know, it didn't have, and people acted pretty responsibly, aside from maybe one or two protests that we saw in Southern California. There weren't like major daily protests about the lockdown in the beginning. And so people behaved really responsibly. Governor Newsom and local leaders demonstrated strong leadership early on, and there was pretty good adherence to those demands of lockdown by the general public. And then they did really well, and they were, you know, it was called the California miracle. And then around Memorial Day, like with most states, they began to open up. And everyone involved in that opening up thought that their plan to open up was sensible and staged and gated and had criteria. So, and what I think we saw was two things. One is, frankly, people got sloppy. People got sloppy with masking in particular. And they got a little bit sloppy with social distancing, because quarantine fatigue is real. Quarantine fatigue is a real phenomenon. I think they expected some bump. Everyone expects some bump of cases with reopening, but the levels that they're seeing are alarming, because I think people were getting a little bit sloppy. Number two, you had a couple of institutionalized outbreaks. There was a pretty large outbreak in San Quentin prison in Northern California. Number three, you know, you got to the level of reopening restaurants and bars, which, and then we started to see little outbreaks around there, and now they've reclosed those. And so all it tells us really is that vigilance is the order of the day, and that the idea that we're going to get back to, or let's say this, our ability to get back to some semblance of normalcy, what we consider normalcy, whether it's going out to eat or going out to socialize, is directly proportional to our willingness as a people to be diligent about the core strategies as individuals we need to take to reduce risk, which is masking, social distancing of 6 feet, and washing hands and avoid touching the face. So this is just a perfect example. California is a perfect example of human failing. And the fact that we can't take an all or nothing approach, we have to employ something akin to a harm reduction approach, which we've learned in pandemic response from things like HIV. You know, abstinence only programs for HIV, both here in the United States and around the world, have never been successful. Mm-hmm. And rather, making the safe choice the easy choice, and allowing people to fail forward, make a mistake and keep going and then correct their behavior, is the only sustainable way to interrupt this process.
Jack in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jack.
Hi. My name's Jeff. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I had a question regarding the mutation rate of COVID-19. I guess I've seen reporting on the mutation as the virus traveled from Europe over to North America. But as we're getting more surges in North America, is the virus continuing to mutate as the surges continue?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
He's asking if the virus is continuing to mutate and change in ways that are going to be more infective. And I guess there's an implication there, too, for people who've had it and recovered, and the uncertainty about immunity.
Yeah, I mean, without getting too complicated, coronavirus is what we call a RNA virus. And we know that RNA viruses mutate very quickly. I have no doubt that it is mutating currently. Now, whether that mutation leads to implications on immunity or the development of a vaccine as in response to that immunity or to elicit that immunity isn't clear at the moment. I will say this, and this is just as a point of fact, coronaviruses in general are a part of three sort of common viruses that cause the seasonal common cold, right? Coronaviruses, rhinoviruses, and enteroviruses. And there, we have never had a vaccine for any of those. We also haven't had vaccines developed as yet for the two major lethal coronavirus outbreaks, which was SARS in 2003-04 and MERS more recently. We don't have vaccines for those. Coronavirus vaccines are hard to develop, and we also haven't really invested into their R&D. So, but also there are innate characteristics about coronaviruses and their mutation rates, as the caller highlights, that make them difficult to develop vaccines for that produce durable immunity. If I had to guess today about what will happen, is that we find this will end up being akin to something like the flu vaccine, where we have a seasonal vaccine that needs to be adapted every year. And some years it's going to be better than others. Is if I had to guess today, that would be my hypothesis going forward. I could be proven wrong, and the vaccine that comes out in early 2021 produces really strong, durable immunity, and that's my hope.
Wait, you just said early 2021. Is that the headline?
Well, I mean, I think that's what even Dr. Fauci said in his last press conference, that he's hopeful that there will be at least one vaccine candidate available in early 2021. Again, you know, a lot has to happen between now and then for that to come to fruition, but that is the timeline that most people are hopeful of.
Question about the Northeast versus other parts of the country now. One of the things that I think you'll agree President Trump probably did right was to close off travel from China as early as he did when the virus was mostly there. New York failed to close off travel from Europe quickly enough, and that was a big cause for the spike in the Northeast. Now travel from the U.S. is banned to a lot of countries. My question is about domestic travel. New York has put a 2-week quarantine requirement on people coming from 16 states that are having spikes. Is that enough, or should New York cancel all airline flights from those states and trains and buses and stop cars with those license plates at the border?
Yeah, it's a really difficult question, not so much because it is complicated with respect to closing down the border or not. It's that we don't have any precedent for this. We really don't know how to do this. When have you ever heard of a state shutting down its border to another state? It just doesn't happen in America, in modern America. And so, you know, it's going to be difficult to implement whatever is decided. So that's just up front. I think it's smart to put in a 14-day requirement from high-risk states. I think what the governor is probably looking at, and what the public health team at the state and even the city level is looking at, is whether there's any sign over the next weeks and months that those states will get their epidemics under control, those high-risk states. And if there isn't, I think they're going to have to consider what you're talking about, which is to shut down flights, which is a pretty dramatic step, but one that, you know, one that could very easily undo all of the gains that we've made here in the Northeast and in New York City through hard-won gains, you know? I mean, I think it wasn't that long ago when we were all pretty frightened and we were experiencing just interminable loss, and what we thought was interminable loss. And so now that we did our job. And so I would not be surprised if that's a question that comes up if we continue to see outbreaks in states that show no signs of getting under control. And so, you know, a state like Florida, for example, which has shown really no desire to get its outbreak under control. And so that is going to be something that the Port Authority and the governor and the city have to deal with going forward if we see this massive this massive disparity in what's happening in New York and other states, because we don't want to undo our gains.
Last thing. I notice in your answers that you have not been advocating going back to a full stay-at-home order like we have had in New York, and that seemed pretty effective in New York. Obviously, it wasn't 100%. All the essential workers who've made the sacrifices and taken the risk that they've had to take have been out there. But for as many people as seemed possible, it was really a stay-at-home order in New York for a while that is beginning to lift. And you're not advocating going back to that, or even really going back to that in the spiking states right now. And I'm curious if it's related to your role as president of Fountain House, the mental health nonprofit, and what you've seen there. Like, how do you compare the public health, mental health effects of extended stay-at-home orders, including the unemployment that brings and the financial hardship, versus the physical health impact, including deaths, of reopening? It's a horrible question to have to ask, but it's where we are.
It's a very difficult question, but I think we talked about California at length. Why did it go wrong, or why is it starting to go wrong? Because people are fed up and people are getting sloppy. And when I say people are getting sloppy, that isn't, you know, that isn't a character attack. That's simply human nature. We can't lock ourselves down for the kinds of time periods that we would need to totally suppress this virus, because we are inherently social creatures, and we know that actually social isolation and preventing ourselves denying ourselves social contact is not just deleterious for your mental health. It actually has real physical health implications. Social isolation is akin to smoking 15 cigarettes a day by some metrics. And so there's real impact on your long-term chronic physical health as well, let alone just the fact that it's hard. It's really hard, and I have a ton of empathy for people. My own family is trying to do this, and you know, I experience it, and it's an incredibly difficult thing we're asking of people to do in the long term, which is why I don't think this kind of cyclical lockdown, reopening cycle is going to benefit anyone in the long term. We need to figure out long-term strategies for suppression of this virus while maintaining some semblance of interaction and integration and opening up of our society. That's to say nothing of the economic effects and their impacts of those economic effects on both physical and mental health, right? What are we at now? 45 million people who have declared unemployment and a looming rent and eviction crisis.
That's right.
These are not just basic impacts in and of themselves. They're impacts on your mental health, on stress and anxiety, on depression, and for people who have pre-existing mental illness, risk factors for crisis, risk factor for decompensation. And so as the head of Fountain House, but also as a public health doctor, I understand that this is not sustainable. Lockdown is not a sustainable way to live. We didn't structure our society that way, and we aren't biologically built that way. So we better come up with ways to live in society while adhering to those basic individual strategies that can reduce risk, like masking, hand washing, social distancing, avoiding touching the face. And from the public policy perspective, our government has to step up and support us to do that by doing two things. One is making real investment into public health and the associated economic and material relief that people need in their lives to get through this period. But number two, making the safe individual choice the easy choice, making masks widely available, making tests widely available. At-home testing needs to be ramped up and scaled up, and making hand sanitizer, hand washing stations widely available, so that we can be out there in the world behaving safely and not denying ourselves the very basic human interaction that is really life-sustaining.
Ashwin Vasan, Professor of Population and Family Health at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, an attending physician at Columbia's Irving Medical Center, and CEO of the mental health nonprofit Fountain House. Thank you so much.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.